So let's start out now talking about hepatocellular cancer. And Philip, I was just sort of reflecting back on the beginning of this year. You know, every year in the beginning of the year, usually in January, there's a so-called ASCO GI meeting. And we did this symposium at ASCO GI on hepatocellular cancer. And it was at the end of January. And of course, you know, we're always asking people, how do you treat patients, et cetera. And we sent out a survey to 25 investigators, and we said, you know, what's your first line therapy, a bunch of things about what they do. But a couple of weeks before that, we were doing another meeting, and actually Philip was one of the faculty people there. And one of the topics was HCC, and we had a poll there, and we sent it out and said, you know, what's your usual first therapy for hepatocellular cancer? Because there had been a big debate between sorafenib and lenvatinib, two tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And so just before we started the meeting, I looked down and I see that Philip, as well as the other docs, wrote in a different answer we didn't even know about, which was atezo-bev. And we're going to talk about this really interesting story. And in fact, when we asked the investigators, what's your usual first-line therapy, whereas 2 months before they were saying sorafenib or lenvatinib, they switched. And so this is not just about HCC. It's about, when does research show you some answers that make you change what you do, like on a dime? And for example, these are the way that our oncologists were responding to the same question a couple weeks before that. You don't even see that option. Again, they were choosing between TKIs. And you can see, again, what happened with the experts. I'm just going to sort of flip through these and just stop for a second and just, you know, take a breath and ask Philip to talk a little bit about this, how this story evolved. Essentially, there was a meeting called ESMO Asia that I never even heard about, where this paper was presented. Philip, we're going to take a look at some of the data, but I'm just, maybe you can reflect a little bit about kind of your thoughts when you first saw the results of this trial.
So basically, this trial really proved a few things that we knew about the disease. Number one, immunotherapy can work in this disease. So atezo is a PD-L1 inhibitor, but by itself, as we know, the immunotherapy, although produces benefit in some patients, durable benefit, but the majority of the patients do not get as much benefit. And then add to it another drug called bevacizumab, which is an anti-angiogenesis drug, which we knew that these tumors have high vascularity, so it makes sense to use a drug like bevacizumab. Putting them together really resulted in some form of synergy that improved the outcome if we compare it to treating with either drug alone. And in fact, the study showed improvement in all the parameters that you and I would like to see to really deem something being very active, like response rate, the shrinkage, like the duration of response, and survival obviously is very important. And then there is some underlying science that explains this, which I can just mention that the bevacizumab probably does something to the microenvironment or the environment within the tumor that makes immunotherapy work better.
And again, we're going to talk more about this advance. You know, this is not the cure of HCC. It's just an important advance that's going to make a big difference to patients. And also, I want to walk you through a few questions that sort of lead you into what we're going to talk about with HCC. So one, in terms of what's actually FDA approved, because actually atezo-bev is not FDA approved at this point, although I think people are using it and they're able to use it because both of the drugs are approved. But Melanie, up until now, we've been using tyrosine kinase inhibitors up front, sorafenib and more recently lenvatinib. Now we're moving to checkpoint inhibitor and bevacizumab, as Philip said. And one of the differences is side effects. And just wonder if you could reflect on what you've seen over the years, Melody, in terms of particularly sorafenib. It kind of has a reputation of not being that easy a drug to use in these patients.
Sure. I think a lot of the patients that I have seen really struggle with fatigue as a primary adverse event or side effect. We do a lot of dose reductions for that tolerability, you know, not being able to do activities of daily living, not being able to get out and exercise due to fatigue. In addition, we also see some laboratory changes, so neutropenia, of course, or thrombocytopenia we've seen, and also have to make dose reductions dependent on those values. Nausea and diarrhea also being very common symptoms that we see in side effects of the drug.
So we'll talk a little bit more about these drugs because they're still being used. I mean, atezo-bev is not the cure of HCC that I know of, and so people go on to get second and third line therapy. And Wells, you know, we see this in lots of cancers that there's a sort of a sequence of agents or therapies that are used on incurable metastatic situations. And we'll talk about how these other ones are starting to fit in now that a lot of people are thinking about atezo-bev. But let's talk a little bit about this regimen and sort of why it is that we switched over so quickly. Can you talk a little bit, Wells, about kind of what the regimen is and what's involved in delivering it?
Sure. So many of the other agents you mentioned are pills, and this is a completely IV regimen. The patients only need to come in every 3 weeks, so it's fairly convenient. And one thing that comes up with pills, especially ones that are very expensive, is they tend to come out of a different part of the patient's insurance. And so you might have a patient where it's covered, but they have a $500 copay, which for a lot of patients is a real struggle. And unfortunately, I think with this COVID thing, with our economy, that struggle is going to become a lot more difficult for patients. So the fact that pills have those copays, deductibles, and donuts can really affect whether or not patients can take it. And as Melanie said, there's a bunch of side effects with those, and many patients just have such severe side effects when they start that other doses have been explored, at least to start with, and I know we'll talk about that. But they're very easy to give. They're fairly quick infusions. And most oncologists have a lot of experience, and nurses, I think, also have experience with these two agents. And so it's a very, you know, convenient, fairly easy regimen to give. And I think that's why you've seen such quick uptake.
Yeah, because you don't often see, you know, new developments where not only you have better efficacy, but better tolerability. And you're right, that's probably a big part of the reason. Tammy, any comments? I know that you have actually quite a bit of experience with this regimen, although, again, it was just published. Any comments about sort of some of the issues that you run into in patients on this regimen?
So in the past couple months, we put on, I'd say in a 10-month period, we probably put on 10 patients on this regimen. They're getting prior auths, even though pre-approved, even though it's not FDA approved. I have to say, this is totally changing the landscape of HCC. Patients are tolerating it quite well. Maybe a little bit of fatigue for a day or two after, but generally really well tolerated. Some blood pressure issues, as usual with Bev, but really a different conversation with HCC patients when it comes to treatment.
So let's talk a little bit about the trial itself that was done and, you know, why the results have changed so much what's being done. So Philip, this is what we call a phase 3 trial. And maybe even before you talk about what this trial shows, just maybe briefly comment on what a phase 3 trial is as opposed to a phase 1 and 2 that would typically precede something like this.
Basically, a phase 3 trial is a study that is done prospectively in a randomized fashion. Why is it randomized? Because we need to know a new treatment, is it different than the existing standard treatment? In this case, the trial is phase 3 because it was randomized and a third of the patients received what we call the control arm, received what is the standard treatment then, which is sorafenib. And then 2/3 of the patients were randomized to receive the experimental treatment. So in building up or coming to the point where you do a phase 3 trial, you really have to have some data of the experimental regimen, in this case, atezo and bevacizumab, that is interesting enough to proceed to a phase 3 trial, because phase 3 trial is a major undertaking, a lot of expense which goes with it, cost, and therefore you don't want to put so many patients into a study that really doesn't have a good chance of being positive. In this case, the pilot trials which were done initially of the combination were very interesting. So that takes you into the phase 2, which is the phase 2 that leads to the phase 3, so pilot trials. And then phase 1 is when you're trying to see whether the drugs really are safe. So the safety goes through phase 1, and then initial look at the efficacy or benefit and safety goes into phase 2. And then ultimately you have to say that, yes, I can say this new regimen is better than what I've been using as a standard treatment. And that's exactly what happened here. Sorafenib was a standard treatment, and the combination did better. And that led to people adopting the use of the combination because it was better than the standard of care, which is sorafenib. And this is exactly what a phase 3 trial does.
And we're going to show the results of this in a second. And Wells, in a second, I want to ask you typically what the situation would be when you're thinking about systemic therapy of HCC, because there are other means to treat it, surgery, can remove it, You can do transplant. You can do intrahepatic therapy. But before we get into that, getting back to the trial issue, Tammy, I'm curious how patients respond to the idea of being randomized. You know, they go in and, maybe there's an exciting development. And this sparks a trial like that. You would think a lot of patients would want to go on the experiment, not want to be randomized to sort of the control arm. I wonder if you run into that issue when people consider phase three trials. Tammy, on the other hand, they have the opportunity to get a therapy maybe they wouldn't get, but they could get randomized to sort of control. How do patients respond to that?
I think there's a mix. I think when there's excitement about a new therapy, of course, people are very anxious about getting randomized to that arm, especially when one of those arms is immunotherapy with all the commercials and media. So when they're not, they're very, disappointed about that. But it's just a par for the course and takes a lot of emotional support through that. But